Here's the dilemma. The number of adults diagnosed with autism is rising, yet we currently have very few evidence-based interventions to offer this population. We seem to be falling short of truly supporting autistic adults. We need to do better, not just by addressing their challenges, but also by bolstering their unique strengths. This podcast episode is going to push you to think big picture about the unmet needs of autistic adults. And hopefully, it will help you address both the challenges and strengths inherent to being neurodivergent in a world that is built for neurotypicals. Our goal is to support you as an occupational therapy professional so you can help autistic adults live a life they love. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we dive deep into research and pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Lyon, OTRL. And before we dive into this week's topic, I wanted to let you know that this podcast episode may qualify as continuing education for you. You are probably listening to this podcast on a free podcast platform, but to gain CEU credit, you need to be a member of the OT Potential Club, our evidence-based practice platform. I'll give you more details at the end of this episode on how you can sign in or sign up to take a test and generate a certificate. But keeping in mind that this is a continuing education course, I wanted to explicitly state our three learning objectives so you can be thinking about them throughout the podcast today. The first is that you will be able to identify unique challenges that autistic adults may face and should inform your practice. The second is that you will be able to recall the self-identified strengths of autistic adults, many of which can be leveraged in your treatments. And third, you will be able to describe how better understanding the strengths and challenges of adults with autism should actually impact your work with kids who are diagnosed with autism. So let's begin by looking at our research study. The study that we are looking at today is called Characterizing the Daily Life, Needs, and Priorities of Adults with Autism Spectrum Disorder from Interactive Autism Network Data. This article comes to us from the journal Autism, and it was published in 2015. So the article begins with this big picture overview of kind of where the research is currently at about supports for adults with autism. Now, autism spectrum disorder is one of the most common diagnoses seen by pediatric occupational therapists. According to the CDC, one in 54 children will be diagnosed with autism. With some basic extrapolation, that means in about 18 years, one in 54 adults will be diagnosed with autism. But the difference in attention given to children with autism versus autistic adults is pretty staggering. For example, the CDC didn't run its first survey of how many U.S. adults live with autism until 2017. And from a funding perspective, things are similarly bleak. Research initiatives examining the unique needs of autistic adults, including the transition from childhood to adulthood, only receive 2% of available research funds from the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. So problem number one is basically that there is not much research out there. But then there's also the second problem. And the second problem is how, quote unquote, outcomes have historically been categorized for these individuals. This paper briefly touches on some of the paradigm shifts that are now occurring in how we currently understand autism and autism supports. Historically, quote unquote, outcomes for this population have been really narrowly focused on functional language, independent living, employment, and traditional understanding of social engagement. With the exception of functional language, which most samples indicate is obtained by 70 to 80% of people with autism, the other outcomes that I just mentioned have traditionally been reported to be, quote unquote, poor. But maybe we've been getting it wrong. Maybe our understanding of quality of life has been too narrow. Maybe we haven't listened closely enough to the voices of autistic people. Maybe the biggest challenges are actually at the environment and society level. where we haven't made enough room for these people's strengths to shine. This paper contributes to this paradigm shift by listening to the lived experiences and priorities of people with autism. So, what was the main research question being studied in this paper? The researchers posed two main questions in their work. First, they wanted to gain a clearer understanding of the lived experiences of autistic adults in the following areas: education, employment, living situation, financial support, adaptive skills, strengths and special interests, physical and mental health, and treatment and service use. The second goal was to understand autistic adults' priorities regarding future research and funding initiatives. This study was conducted through a survey, and to be included in the study, participants needed to be registered with the Interactive Autism Network, and they had to be over the age of 18. The respondents were part of two groups. One group contained people who self-responded, while the other group contained subjects whose names were submitted by legally authorized representatives, such as parents and caregivers. The group ended up being markedly different from previously studied cohorts, not only because the majority were women at 64%, but also because the majority, 73%, weren't diagnosed until adolescence or adulthood, which largely implies a cohort of more mildly affected adults. In our article review in the OT Potential Club, I'm actually going to link to both the surveys that were used, so you can actually go in and see the questions that were part of this survey. So what were the results of this survey? This study presented lots of data to sift through as 255 self-reporting adults responded, as well as 143 legal guardians. I'm going to do my best to pull out some of the highlights by subcategory, beginning with education and vocation. About half of those participants who self-reported had paid employment, while the level for those whose legal guardians responded was closer to a quarter. Interestingly, both groups reported wanting more work hours. 42% of the self-reported group and 20% of the legal guardians group reported facing discrimination in the workplace. For residential settings and financial support, in the self-reporting group, about 20% lived independently and 40% reported living with a spouse or a partner. In the legal guardian group, only about 7% lived alone, with most living with their parents. In the abilities and special interests category, the respondents just did a great job of self-identifying their strengths that supported them in their work, education, and hobbies. And some examples of these skills included ability to intensely focus, honesty, creativity, good memory, and sense of justice. In the category of co-occurring health conditions and treatments, the percentage of respondents reporting co-occurring health conditions, particularly mental and emotional health conditions, was pretty strikingly high. About 75% of those in the self-reporting group reported anxiety or depression. There were also really common physical conditions that were reported, including challenges with sleep, allergies, and intestinal issues. And finally, in the priorities for future research, some of the highest priorities included, number one, understanding and acceptance of autism by the general population. Number two, how to improve the life skills of people with autism. And number three, mental and emotional health in people with autism. So what did the authors conclude and discuss from this research? The authors made it clear that funding and future research in this area needs to focus on vocational engagement, understanding of autism by the larger population, and mental and emotional health of autistic adults. These weren't just the areas that the authors felt were most important. These were also the self-reported priorities of autistic adults. The authors also stressed that people with autism and their families need to be part of the decision-making process when it comes to research funding moving forward. So what were my takeaways for OT practitioners from this research? As always, these are just my personal takeaways, and they were not mentioned specifically in the research. My first takeaway was that this is yet another call to balance our general occupational therapy approach with condition-specific considerations. all while listening to the unique individual that is sitting in front of us. The priorities listed by the survey participants really align with our OT skill set. After all, we are heavyweights in vocational training, workplace readiness, community education, and holistic interventions. Plus, we are the only members of the rehab team with a unique understanding of mental health conditions. So this paper really felt like a call to action to use your general OT approach, but also to take into consideration the unique comorbidities, challenges, and strengths of autistic adults. And above all else, to listen to the patient in front of you. My second takeaway was that increasing our understanding and acceptance starts with examining ourselves. It really hit home for me that one of the most important goals of this community, really like any community, is simply understanding and acceptance. This, I'm sure, is directed at therapists too. We need to continually look at our own attitudes and assumptions. And my third takeaway is that it can feel like quote-unquote peds therapists and adult therapists operate in two different worlds. But we need to build a bridge in order to best meet the needs of autistic adults. There is a push within healthcare to increase collaboration between professions because it simply makes sense that this would lead to the best outcomes. But this article really brought to mind that we also need to build bridges within our own profession. Sometimes peds therapists and adult therapists operate so differently that our work can almost feel foreign to each other. We tend to peg people who primarily work with autistic patients as peds therapists. But to truly meet the needs of this population and all populations, we need to be paying attention to practice advances outside of just the populations that we tend to treat. We need to move towards a place in our profession where therapists working in an inpatient setting is just as equipped to meet the unique needs of someone on the spectrum as a school therapist. So to help us unpack what that looks like in practical terms, I am going to bring on our expert guest. And our expert guest today is Meg Proctor, who is the founder of Learn, Play, Thrive, where she teaches therapists to use a deep understanding of autism learning styles to guide their work. Meg is the host of her own podcast, Two Sides of the Spectrum, designed to help OTs better take the perspective of their neurodivergent clients. And just as a financial disclosure, Meg has her own AOTA-approved course, the Learn, Play, Thrive Approach to Autism, which she naturally benefits from financially. You'll hear in our conversation that I have taken this course and I am definitely a fan of it, but I don't have any financial stake in her work. So I'll go ahead and patch Meg onto our call. Welcome to the podcast, Meg. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Sarah. I am thrilled to be here.
I wanted to start by having you introduce yourself. I said a little bit about your course before I patched you in, but I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what got you interested in the topic of autism to begin with, kind of your path that's led you up to this point.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an unexpected story because my whole business centers around autism now. But when I was in graduate school for occupational therapy, I remember there was a scholarship for people who wanted to work with autistic kids. And I know we'll talk about language later and I'll explain why I say autistic. Of course, at the time it was kids with autism. And I didn't apply for that scholarship because I didn't want to work with kids on the spectrum. And what I said at the time and what I continued saying through my field works was that it wasn't a good fit for my personality. But what I meant was the behavioral intervention style that I had seen didn't feel right to me in my core. I didn't like it. I wasn't good at it. I didn't want to do it. And so I said, I'm just going to not work with kids on the autism spectrum. And of course, I went into peds and I did work with autistic kids. But I, over time, was able to find a different way that really did feel person affirming and helped me feel like the OT I wanted to be and also effective. But my road there was really challenging because I came out of OT school with kind of a long list of things I wanted to not do. But I had never really seen in practice what I wanted to do. And I didn't even have the language for it. I didn't know what a strengths-based approach was. And I didn't know about listening to autistic people to learn about them. I really had a lot of missing pieces, but I didn't know what they were. So I struggled and I felt overwhelmed and I felt ineffective in early intervention. I felt less overwhelmed, but equally kind of ineffective in the schools. And I eventually got this appointment as a faculty member for UNC Chapel Hill's Teach Autism program. And that's where I really learned about autism as a culture and a learning style. And all of a sudden, everything fell into place. And I had the tools to start practicing in a way I wished I always had been. So it was exciting for me in my career to pivot from working from them, working for them, working with kids and also teaching and training lots of people who weren't OTs, to teaching and training OTs, because we're starving for a different approach that feels really aligned with who we are at our core. So that's kind of how I got from, I don't want to do this, to I do want to, I just want it to look different and I want to share that with others.
And I'm all in and I have a business and
I'm all in.
Yes. Yes. No, and what I've always admired about your trainings is it feels to me like you're taking these concepts and approaches that to me felt like maybe they've always been very specialty and felt like maybe they were happening somewhere, but then it's, you made it accessible to someone like me. And that is just such a great service to our profession, what you've done with all that. So yeah, thank you for that journey that you've been on and sharing it with us.
Yeah, I love that. I'm not a fan of jargon and highly specialized intervention and making what we do seem overly complicated when it's really helping people use their strengths to engage more fully in their daily lives. It doesn't have to require a whole new vocabulary or some sort of certification to be able to be successful at that. But it does require a toolbox full of relevant tools.
Yeah. And I'm really happy that we're talking about adults with autism today. But before we get to that specifically, even broader than that, I've always worked with adults and definitely never thought of myself as someone who had expertise in working with autism. But your trainings really changed how I would approach working with any adult, that strength-based approach. I think we like hear it, especially in the adult world, and play lip service to it. But it's really powerful to see that played out. And I hope that that framework just like can get applied more broadly. But before we get into some of that bigger picture stuff, I wanted to start with talking about language. And I wanted to start there partially because I wrote the review of this article and I just found myself like cringing as I was writing because I was trying to reflect what was in the article, but it was using, first of all, phrases like adults with autism, but then also high functioning and low functioning and condition and disease. And there are times when some of these words feel more appropriate, like condition matches with, I don't, like Parkinson's or I like, yeah, it matches some places in the writing that we do. But when we're talking about a population where this is their identity, these words felt just cringeworthy. So I was wondering if you could speak to, I think specifically those four words, adults with autism, high functioning, low functioning, and then the terms like condition, disease.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of nailed it when you said this is their identity. So most of us were taught somewhere along the line to use person first language, meaning separate the person from the autism and say person with autism. And that makes sense when we're talking about cancer, right? It's not a cancer person. It's a person with cancer. Cancer is a disease that person certainly wants to be separated from. But when you talk to autistic people, the vast majority of autistic adults prefer identity first language. They say, I am autistic. This is an important part of my identity. Stop trying to separate me from it. And there's been some interesting research that shows that person first language actually increases stigma because we only use it for things that we deem as bad. Right? So it's perfectly acceptable to say a neurotypical child because it's okay to be neurotypical. But then we say a child with autism because there's something wrong with being autistic. We want to separate that out from the person. But that whole concept has come from non-autistic people. And it's a little arrogant of us to say, you're more than your diagnosis. Yeah, of course, everybody is more than one adjective, but it doesn't mean they need to be separated from it in the way we use language. So of course, there's space for personal preference. There are autistic people who prefer to be called a person with autism or a neurodivergent person. But the majority of autistic people prefer the language of autistic. And that's a hard shift. It's hard in terms of your habits. Like you're totally on board and you might still say person with autism. It's taken me a long time to stop saying that just out of habit. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because we as OTs often sort of cringe when we hear autistic. We think somebody is out of date and using this old and offensive language. And that's an opportunity to explain, oh yeah, I just said autistic. Let me explain why. Autism is not a disease. Autistic people like being called autistic. It's just a different way of thinking and learning. The high functioning, low functioning piece is really just not that useful and can be damaging. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine you're an autistic person who has a lot of language and is intellectually typical to your peers or even, you know, brighter, very successful at work, whatever. But your sensory differences and your executive function challenges are so profound that you can't get through your day, that you didn't get out of bed last week, and you're called high functioning. What does that even mean? It doesn't describe your own experience of being an autistic person in the world. What if you are non-speaking, but you are very happy and very bright and understand everything, and you're called low functioning? On my podcast, I interviewed a non-speaking autistic person who learned to type in elementary school. And he said that, you know, he understood everything everybody was saying about him, and it diminished his hope when he had to listen to people call him low functioning. Mm. So that's really our perception of people, and it's not their experience of the world. So instead, we need to just be a little more descriptive. Mm-hmm. A 5-year-old who uses a lot of language and struggles with sensory sensitivity. A 7th grader in a typical classroom who, you know, is not turning in his homework. A 5-year-old who is non-speaking and loves playing the piano, right? Whatever you want to say, but those words aren't specific. And then you can kind of infer about disorder, condition, all of that. It treats it not as a culture or a difference, but as a problem and a disease and something to be changed. It can't be changed. We shouldn't. That's not our job.
Yeah. And as I was writing, I did have trouble staying away from the word condition because we're so trained to talk and think in that way. And that was just a huge signal to me that I have a ton of work to do on how I use language. And I think we will have new language for it at some point.
Yeah, I think that shift is happening, but it's, you know, it's complicated because we work within a medical model. So, you know, I know later we'll talk about strengths-based approaches and people say, but how do I document deficits for insurance reimbursement?
Yeah.
You know, so we're kind of working in a model that monetarily prioritizes medicalizing a person's challenges. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky, but regardless of that, we can be responsible for the shifts in how we think about our clients and
yes.
how we engage with them.
Yeah, how we treat them. So let's move to what supports, now I'm questioning that word, are currently available to autistic adults, specifically noting ones where OTs are involved.
Yeah, I think I like the word supports, by the way.
Okay, good.
But I'm not the authority. So yeah, I think the answer to this is going to differ depending on where you are. But that in itself is interesting because if you ask me what supports are available to autistic kids, I say early intervention, school-based services, clinic-based services. It's pretty standard and pretty robust. And as children transition into adulthood, services kind of depend on where you are. And a lot of them aren't provided by OTs. A lot of job support is done by vocational therapists who can do a really excellent job of that. And there certainly could be a role for OT there too, but there often isn't outside of special programs. There are OTs working with autistic adults in their homes and in the communities. But there's certainly a lot less services as people move into adulthood, especially coming from OTs specifically geared towards helping autistic people thrive in their daily lives. That said, all OTs work with autistic people.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
You could be working in acute care and you have an autistic adult who's had a stroke. And you could be working in a skilled nursing facility and you have an autistic adult. So it's even more important in those places as compared to like a residential facility that's built for people who think and learn differently. When you're in a hospital, that isn't made for anyone's comfort and positive experience, yes. much less an autistic person, to be able to take the perspective of your autistic client and be able to understand what's happening for them and support them given what we know about autism.
So to better serve autistic adults, do you think that more OTs who work in adult rehab need to specialize in working with autistic clients? Do you think we need like more specific services, or do you think everyone in every setting just needs to improve our skill set at working with this clientele?
I think that's a yes and kind of answer.
Yeah. I was thinking as I was asking it, kind of.
Yeah, because we'll talk about this a lot, but if we shift to thinking of autism as a culture, then we need to be culturally competent in autism. So I wouldn't say, oh no, everybody on the rehab team doesn't need to learn what to work with Latino people. Yeah. We have, this one person who specializes in that. It's like, no, we all kind of need to learn cultural competence and then increase our skills and understanding in that area as needed. But maybe you also have somebody who really has some skills and expertise in this area who can take on that client or who can consult and collaborate with you so that you can be more successful with that client.
Yeah, I really like that both and answer. But I think I also want to ask just in general, what supports are lacking for this population right now?
Yeah, I think this answer would really be different for every autistic adult who you asked, right? Like, oh, I need help with my figuring out how to manage money in my apartment, or I need help with what can I do during my break at work that I enjoy but that won't make other people uncomfortable? Or how do I get a girlfriend, right? So it's going to be different for every person who you ask or if you ask the people supporting that person. But, you know, our culture generally lacks supports for adults, for all adults. I mean, I think everybody who is an adult is probably nodding, thinking about all the times we could have used some coaching and therapy and support that isn't really a part of our culture. If you think about autistic adults can certainly thrive, but they don't thrive with the way the world is set up, because it is set up for neurotypical people, period. Mm-hmm. And it is so hard to thrive in an environment that's really not set up to your strengths at all. So the supports that are there, unfortunately, often, not always, but often come from people who don't really understand and accept autistic ways of being. So, you know, the field of autism intervention sort of has an ugly history of trying to teach autistic people to act non-autistic. And if you track back ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, which isn't OT, but in the absence of our own strong OT frameworks for how to work with autistic people, we draw from those around us. And I see a lot of OTs using a very strong behavioral lens. One of the founders and creators of ABA at the same time created gay conversion therapy to teach gay people to act not gay. And when you look at it in that lens, we're trying to teach autistic people to stop acting autistic. It can't be surprising, the research, that that type of intervention leads to post-traumatic stress syndrome and to suicidality. Because autistic people can't become less autistic. They can be accepted and supported and thrive. But all that teaching them to not act and seem autistic does is teach them to mask and hide their autism. And anyone who's tried to do something similar knows that feels terrible. And that's not who we are as a profession and not what we should be doing. So my, in a nutshell, answer to what supports are lacking is that autistic people generally lack supports from people who accept them and understand them, or try to, and want to help them really thrive in their daily lives rather than try and change them based on our neurotypical norms and standards.
So I'm sold that we need to do better. What would you say are opportunities for us as occupational therapists to do better by this population?
Yeah. So one way we really limit ourselves is with the lens that we use. Most of us were trained to be occupational therapists, right? To look at occupations and daily activities. But somewhere along the way, for a lot of people, their lens narrows into what they know how to do or what they're good at or what they're interested in. And a lot of people become behavioral therapists or sensory therapists, or even fine motor therapists. And that is a very limited lens. And if that is how you understand your client, that's what your intervention is going to be. But one thing that we can do is to use a strong autism learning styles lens. So when we really learn about how autistic people think, learn, experience the world, when we look at the actual latest research that has changed since most of us went to OT school, even recently, or we might not have been exposed to the right things in OT school. And when we listen to autistic adults talk about their experiences, we can sort of shed some of our culturally oppressive ideas about autism and learn something totally different that will help us take the perspective of our clients. So here's an example. Most of us were taught, and I used to say over and over again, autistic people struggle with perspective taking and social skills. Well, there's this interesting concept called the double empathy problem. And it was the idea of an autistic researcher, but then the research was carried out by a team. And what they found was that when they put autistic people with other autistic people, they were pretty good at sharing information between them. And when they put non-autistic people with non-autistic people, they were similarly good. Also, the autistic people reported similar levels of satisfaction with the social experience as did the non-autistic only groups. When they mixed the groups, both sides were struggling. Autistic people were struggling. Non-autistic people were struggling. Everybody found it awkward. Nobody was communicating well. And it throws out the window this idea that autistic people are bad at perspective taking and social skills. You know what? Non-autistic people are terrible at taking the perspective of our autistic clients. And we're pretty bad at using the social skills that are expected and comfortable for them. So neurotypicality is one paradigm. It's not a better paradigm. It's not the right paradigm. Autism is, or neurodivergence is another paradigm. It's not bad. It's not inferior. It's just a paradigm. So really learning about autism learning styles, we can stop saying, oh, you need to learn perspective taking. Oh, you need to learn social skills. And instead say, okay, maybe this goes both ways. Maybe it's hard for you to take the perspective of non-autistic people, and maybe it's hard for the non-autistic people in your life to take your perspective. And there's just so many other things like this in how an autistic person thinks and learns that we've kind of gotten wrong, or we overlook, or we just have a really hard time considering because nobody's good at taking anybody else's perspective in this way. So moving beyond the behavior and sensory lens, really diving deep into autism learning styles so that we can understand our clients and approach them in a more effective way.
Yeah, I love what I hear you saying because it really correlates with what I read in this journal article where the top priority for the people who took this survey was understanding and acceptance. And I'm like, that's something that we need to be working on. Like, as an individual, as a society, that's a way that we need to be changing, not a special intervention we need to do or a treatment. That's us working on ourselves. So I think specifically to pivot to OTs who are in practice, they maybe don't consider themselves an expert. But like you said, we're all seeing clients who are autistic and we want to serve them as well as we can. What specific recommendations would you give to an OT who's just in like a standard adult rehab practice setting, like SNF, acute, inpatient, and they have an autistic client? Are there any specific recommendations that you would give to them?
Yeah, I love your point, Sarah, that the work starts with ourselves. Because often, especially newer therapists, feel this pressure to do interventions and show progress and prove that they are actually occupational therapists who know things. And I have so been there, not an adult, but if I moved into adults, I'm sure I would feel a lot of imposter syndrome. But really starting with ourselves and being open to learn from our clients about our clients rather than making therapy about us proving our skills and easing our own anxiety that maybe we don't know what we're doing. And even for more experienced therapists, this can also happen in the ways that we come in and forget to learn from and about the people who we're working with. And sometimes that means listening to other autistic voices. So there's a lot that can be learned for people who are working with autistic people by listening to, reading the voices of other autistic adults to learn about some of those insights that we're probably not going to get from each individual client, but we should really have in our minds to become culturally competent in autism, because it doesn't just happen by will of force. Right? We don't just say, okay, autism is a culture, so I'm going to be culturally competent. It does take a little bit of work. The other concrete thing is thinking about our clients' self-identity. There's an autistic OT who I collaborate with, Sarah Salvaggi Hernandez, and she brought this concept up to me, and I had this moment of like, oh my gosh, how have I never thought about the impact that my work has on a client's identity, their self-identity, a child or an adult. Do we want to be emphasizing their deficits and the things that they're struggling with and the ways that they're different or what they're doing is unexpected or how they need to improve? Or do we want to be really building them up with a sense of what they're good at and why that's awesome and how their differences are important and needed in the world and that the world kind of sucks sometimes for not helping them thrive given those differences. So if we think, how is my work going to impact my client's sense of self? How can I learn from them about them, what they need, what they're good at, what they're interested in? And how can I learn about autism as a culture from other autistic adults? I think that's a great place to start. And then on a more practical level, when we develop supports, they need to fit into our clients' lives and address their own goals. And they need to be simple and sustainable. Often we can get kind of performative with autism interventions. We're like, I made this beautiful visual thing that I found on Pinterest without really learning about, is this what you need? Is this what would help you? Can you imagine using this? Do you want something like this? And does this even relate to your goals for yourself? I interviewed an OT professor recently whose work centers around self-determination. And he talks about letting people set goals for themselves, even if they're not realistic, and then walking through that process with them so they can learn about goal setting, right? So when we're working with adults, we have a real opportunity to help people learn about themselves, their strengths, what they need, how to advocate for what they need, and how to set their own goals and work towards meeting them.
Yeah, that all just fits so well with so much of the research that we're saying. And this isn't specific to working with autistic clients. This is working with all patients. Like, all patients want their strengths to be focused on. And that's how we overcome challenges too. We overcome challenges by harnessing our strengths, not by like focusing on what we're bad at. Like,
nobody builds their life around the things they're bad at. Yes. It just makes you miserable.
Yes. And to your point about how sometimes, especially as a new therapist, you're anxious and just want to do something and it almost becomes performative, I do see this sign of growth, or just you get to a new level of confidence where you can let the patient be the expert in the room on their lives, which obviously they are, but that's something that as therapists, we need to keep getting better at no matter what patient that we're working with.
Yeah, absolutely. I imagine a lot of therapists are great at that until they meet somebody who thinks and learns differently. Yes. And then there might be this desire to stay in control a little bit more. And yep. I don't know. I can imagine having felt that way without having learned to question it.
Yeah, we always want to overlay our worldview onto everyone's lives, and that's a lot of work on our parts to not do that, because that is our natural tendency. The one other question I wanted to be sure to ask about, something that the paper brought up, was that even though we're looking from a strength-based lens, there's still specific challenges that can go along with being autistic. For example, they talked about more vocational challenges for this population. Knowing some of the challenges that autistic adults face, how should that impact our pediatric practices? How can we be preparing these kids for adulthood?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sarah, because autistic kids grow into adults. Before I started working at UNC's Teach Autism program, UNC had written this paper that was born out of opening a closet door, literally opening a closet door and finding a ton of files. And it was the files of the first kids they diagnosed as autistic in the 70s at Teach. And they went back and found those kids again as adults to study positive adult outcomes. Were the adults happy? Were they employed? Were they living on their own? Were they in long-term partnerships? And they were psychologists doing this research. And one of them joked to me in my job interview there that, you know, I'm a psychologist. I wanted the biggest link from childhood to positive adult outcomes to be like IQ score or, you know, vocabulary. And she was like, it wasn't. It was daily living skills, adaptive behaviors. And she was like, we need to hire an OT. And I was like, I read that study too. And I was going to say, you need to hire an OT. So we need to not overlook daily living skills for autistic kids. But also what I was talking about with identity in adults, that starts early. Mm-hmm. And it starts with parents too. Parents want to see their kids' strengths, and they're taught by professionals to see all of the things that are wrong, all of the ways their kids aren't hitting the same milestones, all of the interventions they need to be doing. And we can do that differently. We can hone in on why it's awesome that their kid thinks and learns differently, how we can celebrate it, and how we can support that child to feel happy and engaged in their life in a way that's authentic to them. And a strengths-based approach doesn't mean ignoring challenges. You know, every child has to learn a lot of things, and autistic kids learn differently. So they need more help often learning some of the things they need to do in their lives or even that they want to do in their lives. So we need to be skillful at doing that in a way that builds on their strengths and also isn't compliance-based. Because a lot of the strategies that OTs use with kids have come out of behavioralism and aren't person-affirming. So we do things like we write a goal for a kid to do something. We can't get them to do it, so we take their hands and help them do the activity. And I want to be clear, I'm not talking about a child who's engaged in an activity and just struggling with something about the motor skill and we get their permission and we help them. I'm talking about kids who we don't know how to engage them, so we move their bodies for them. Mm. That needs to stop yesterday. because I believe that my fellow OTs believe that children have a right to control their own bodies. And I think we just forget that it's our job to respect their autonomy. It's in our code of ethics to respect their autonomy and to teach them and to affirm that their bodies are their own. And adults don't have the right to move their bodies for them just to get them to do what we want them to do. It's a different story for parents. Like, they have to get through their day. Yeah. You know, I'm not preaching to parents here, but OTs need different tools. We need to be able to set appropriate engaging goals and connect a child to an activity and teach in a way that's meaningful and not move their bodies. And you know, I'd be remiss to say that without talking about sexual assault, because autistic kids and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in general are at a much higher rate of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And when we move their bodies without their consent, we're teaching them people in authority have a right to your body, and you don't get to say yes or no. And that is not the message that we want to be sending. So we need to get our hands off of kids, and we need to teach differently. But compliance-based approaches go beyond hand over hand as well. Often something that therapists do, and it's well-meaning, but it's poorly conceived, is to withhold the thing that that child loves to get them to do something else. And, you know, we say first this, then that. And, you know, imagine if you loved reading and really didn't like doing your like bookkeeping for your business, and somebody just sort of dangled you reading your novel for you can't do it until after you do your bookkeeping. It makes you dislike bookkeeping even more because now you're yes. just doing it to get to this thing that you love. But it's also inherently not strengths-based to withhold the things that are the most engaging and the most interesting to a child in order to sort of cajole them into doing the things we want them to do. And it comes from a lack of other skills. We think my job is to get the child to do something to meet their goals. And it's not. It's not the best advice a mentor gave me. It was, she was like, Meg, your problem is you and other OTs think you can get any child to meet any goal. And that's not your job. Your job is to learn from and about the child and support them to do the next thing that they're ready for. And that was like a huge paradigm shift for me. And I just share that at every opportunity I can because I felt less stressed and also less inclined to do these sort of coercive things to my clients when I realized that that wasn't my job, was to wield authority and make them do goal-directed things. That's not us at our best. So teaching positive autistic self-identity, identifying and building on strengths, because people build their lives around their strengths. People build their jobs around their strengths. You have no idea what that child is learning from watching the credits over and over. Or I just had somebody on my podcast give an example of a little girl who had a knitting needle that she was waving around, and she was making rainbows in the refractions. And the OT thought it was just not important stimming that should be changed. Like, we have no idea the beauty and meaning that our autistic clients are finding in what they do. And because we don't understand it doesn't mean we should take it away. So that's two things: positive identity, moving away from compliance-based strategies. I have two more. So supporting autistic clients, we knew this in OT school that the whole burden of change shouldn't be on the client. There's lots of models of occupational therapy practice that talk about the transactional nature between the person and their environment and the activity. But somehow we forget that sometimes, and we start just trying to teach the client to do new skills, to do things differently, to learn something, to change something. The burden of change shouldn't just be on the client, right? Like, if we're using this cultural model and neurotypicality is a culture that doesn't work well for autistic people, we can do some of the work. Non-autistic people can do some perspective taking. A person's peers can learn about that person, and we can take that into adulthood. So our job isn't to fade out the supports. Our job is to teach a kid to say, hey, I'm autistic, if they want to say that, or they can just say, I don't learn very well from what I hear, but I'm great at following a set of written instructions. Can you write that down for me? So our job isn't to fade out their need for written instructions any more than it is for you to fade out your glasses, right? It's for them to be able to ask for it and the people around them to be able to provide that. Mm-hmm. I have autistic people who I work with who will write in the PS of an email, PS, sometimes my autism looks like this and this and that. Don't misinterpret that when we're interacting. Now I get to do the work of not being sensitive and narrow and thinking that the way that they're interacting, which is different, is about me, or that I have the right explanation for it. So we can teach a child about what they need to be successful and teach them how to get it from an early age without the goal of making them not need it. Mm-hmm. The question that this calls up for a lot of therapists is, how do I know what they need? And that goes back to what we were talking about before. We have to be better at watching and learning from our clients, less anxious to jump in and do an intervention, and more ready to put on our detective hat and learn about them from them through a real process of informal assessment. How is this going now? What has helped you in the past? What happens when you try to do the activity? What do I know about how you think and learn? What happens when I give you this support, right? So not a beautifully executed intervention, but a trial and error back and forth process with the client where we are watching and learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of that does just feel so true of all clients that we're seeing, to focus on strengths, to be listening and affirming and take delight in our clients. I think that we all went into OT because we wanted to partner with clients. We enjoy working with our clients. And I think that sometimes that's a part of us that we need to reclaim. Like, we've been taught to be so deficit focused, to be quote unquote experts that sweep into the room. And we need to reclaim what brought us to OT in the first place. I'm really sad because our time is running out, but I wanted to give you a moment to say what you think is the most important takeaway for someone who's listening to this episode today.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing we can do is to be open to and eager for things that create massive paradigm shifts in our work, rather than being closed off and resistant to them. Because most of what a lot of us were taught about autism is limited, lacking, sometimes completely off target. But we can be open to that and say to our clients in real life or in our heads, I misunderstood you. I misunderstood autism. I did not have cultural competence. I forgot about autonomy, whatever it is. Let me try something different starting tomorrow, and let me learn some new skills so that I know how to do something different. So rather than falling into this is what I've been trained to do, this is what I do, maybe I just shouldn't do it, sort of anxious reaction, or, you know, burying your head in the sand. I personally in my work have been so impressed with how OTs take some of this information, which is a big shift. It's been a big shift for me. I didn't come up with any of this and didn't know any of this, you know, however many years ago. And I've just had to continually say, let me do that differently now. How can I do that differently? And what do I need to learn to do that? So I think that's what we as OTs need to do. We need to listen and learn and sometimes apologize and transform what we're doing based on our status as lifelong learners.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for your role in helping us to shift our paradigms. Thank you for your time today, and I'm eager to keep talking to you in the future about this.
Well, thank you, Sarah, and thank you for all you do to keep us all at the absolute top of our game. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Wow, you guys, I felt like on this episode, you could hear me being pushed to learn and grow in real time. I literally went into my website afterwards and changed a lot of the language I was using around this topic. A huge thanks to Meg for being the kind of teacher that really pushes us not only to be better professionals, but just to be better human beings. If you are interested in earning a continuing education certificate for your time today, what you are going to do next is head to otpotential.com and either sign in or sign up for the OT Potential Club. Once you're in the club, you are going to want to click on the button that says CEU Courses. And from there, you'll be prompted to take a 5-question test. And if you earn 75% or higher, you will have a certificate sent to your inbox. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope this podcast helps you broaden your knowledge, tweak your practice, and stay evidence-based. Take care, stay safe, and we'll talk to you next month.